Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cork and Dublin Airports. Bringing friends and families together. Wishing you a very happy Christmas.
Good morning. It may well be the season of goodwill, but tell that to the Fianna Fáil faithful. They gathered on Tuesday night for a meeting that lasted almost 5 hours. Up for discussion, the report into the party's handling of the election for the presidency. On Morning Ireland, here's Justin with political correspondent Micheál Lehane.
Can you tell us first about the meeting last night, the tone of it, how it played out, and what party members had to say about the presidential election campaign?
Well, Justin, there's a central charge from party members that essentially they were sidelined, that this was handled by the party leadership, who gave the backing early to Jim Gavin in circumstances that has left some of them confused. Things like the fact that there was no polling data done on him specifically, and the fact that there was one meeting, it seems, with the party leader before he gave his imprimatur to Jim Gavin. Some from the floor saying things and making claims that Jim Gavin was kept from the media view at certain points. They say, was that illustrative of a view within the leadership that he had shortcomings for this particular contest? Overall, the tone is one of anger from many. Some describe it as brutal and even nasty at times. And unlike previous meetings when this has been discussed, where there has been mea culpas from Micheál Martin, where he did utter acts of political contrition, I think he was very much on the defensive last night. There are at certain points in the exchanges words like lies are thrown around in what are fairly bitter exchanges with some of his colleagues. He leaves it all at the end of it intact, which, of course, in any political contest is the most important thing. Power has been maintained and retained, and that is the key thing. At the same time, I think there are some even on that middle ground who maybe said very little last night who believe he walks on thin ice now.
And then a little later with David McCullough, the man himself, Taoiseach Micheál Martin.
At the root of all this is a very, very simple question. What made you think that a media-shy candidate with no political experience could win the toughest, most searching election in Irish politics?
Well, at the outset, what made me think, first of all, up to June, July, no candidates had emerged from within the parliamentary party. Make that point first. So we didn't have heavy hitters from within the PP. And maybe that's in terms of maturity of the party, in terms of there was a time historically when you'd have the Brian Lenehan's, Michael O'Kennedy's. No, just make my point. And I remember that back in 97, Mary McAleese came out.
Yeah.
Literally not as well known, but a good broadcaster and also had good views. But Jim Gavin did come to the table with very significant strengths. Particularly, he was very popular in the first instance because of his sporting success. But he also had significant involvement.
Well, he was popular in Dublin.
But he also had significant experience in terms of UN military and so on. I had appointed him to Citizens Assembly. He did that job very competently. He then chaired the North East Inner City very competently. And even at the first poll that was taken, media poll in September, had him in a very competitive position. I then took informal soundings from people who worked with him in the different areas of life that he was engaged in. Extremely positive. And some of the commentary initially was very positive about Jim Gavin.
Yeah, until we saw him on the telly.
I take your point. I think one senator in the party put it very well. We probably took him out of his comfort zone.
And then they got into the selection process, the timelines, the potential candidates that might have come forward.
But in retrospect, yes, there are lessons here. Like, our process is not correct. We did nothing different to what happened in 97 and 1990, but it's not a good process.
Yeah.
If I could make the point, what should happen into the future, there should be certain deadlines set. Mm. People should put their hands up if they want to be candidates much earlier.
Okay, but people did put their hands up. Bertie Ahern put his hand up. Mary Hannafin put her hand up. Cynthia Niemiecka put her hand up. And they all expressed interest if they had your backing. They were all left twisting in the wind until Sean Dorgan told them you weren't backing them.
Well, sorry, in terms of it, and to go through the individuals concerned, all of them, I mean, Mary Hannafin would have said to me, you'll decide. And I said, well, actually, the parliamentary party ultimately will decide. And the process, bad and all, the process basically was, the rules are clear, you need the support of the parliamentary party. Hmm. Now, I know why Mary would have said that in previous times. The leader would give a direction, or maybe not a direction, but would say, I think this candidate is the best candidate and so on like that. But in that context, however, any soundings I did at the time were not responsive. I mean, I don't want to be talking about individual candidates within the PP. Mm. I mean, this was, there's a lot of informal soundings going on, but that's in, I accept that into the future, that's not a basis for how we select candidates.
But you had chosen your candidate. Election. You had chosen your candidate by the end of July, and you didn't tell anyone until the end of August.
On the 1st of August, Jim Gavin committed. We felt that August was, I mean, there was people popping up everywhere in August. We felt August was the wrong month to launch a campaign. No one at that stage, Cynthia hadn't got, Cynthia came later in August. And to be fair, Billy came quite late in August. And in fact, in the middle of August, and I don't want to go back over all this.
But if they'd known that you had a candidate, they wouldn't have bothered.
Well, no, but sorry, if someone, but look, Billy.
Like that was the whole point Kelleher. He wanted Fianna Fáil to contest the election. He didn't know that you had a candidate, and that's why.
Billy messaged me saying, you know, it was a matter of it was unimportant to him. In other words, the WhatsApp from Billy on the 14th of August was that he certainly wasn't going to be a candidate. That was what I took from that. No, Billy said I took the wrong conclusion from that, and I'm fair enough. We all have different perspectives, but the WhatsApp was very clear at the time. But I don't want to be going back over all of that. Billy Kelleher is a fine parliamentarian and so on, but I got no indication from Billy that he wanted to be a candidate until around the 26th or 27th.
My question is slightly different. My question is, Dave, you had a choice. You had made your choice. You didn't bother telling anyone.
No, but Dave.
And this was the final question put to Taoiseach Micheál Martin.
This thing has dragged on since the disaster of Jim Gavin's retirement from the campaign, and it may well still go on. I think Pat the Cope Gallagher said this isn't over yet. You could put a stop to this immediately, put down a motion of confidence in yourself for the parliamentary party.
Again, I think it has dragged on too long, but again, you know, it was.
Could you put down a motion of confidence?
No, I'm not going to do that because I'm concentrating on government. No, I don't believe I need to. I don't believe I need to at all. I've had substantial engagement with TDs and senators now over the last 2 months. This was a major, major setback. It was a devastating outcome for the party. I didn't want this. And I've made it very clear, I take full responsibility. I'm sorry for what happened. I said this to the party membership. In the round, we did well in the general election. We did well in the locals. We did well in the European. We did badly in the presidential. Wrong calls were made. I take responsibility for it.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin. And later on the News at One, would-be candidate Cynthia Ní Bheorchú, well, less than impressed.
Do you believe then that you could have won?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt in my mind, to the extent that I contacted on Taoiseach as soon as Mairead McGuinness had officially withdrawn on the 14th of August by text. And on the evening of that, on my holidays in West Cork, I texted on Taoiseach basically to say, with no preconditions, as is suggested in the report, that I would only run if I got the support of the leader. That was not communicated at all. So on the 14th of August, which was exactly 2 weeks or in excess of 2 weeks before the actual official nomination and proposal of Jim Gavin by an Taoiseach, there was two very important weeks. Now, I didn't leave it there, Rachel. And what's missing from the report is a number of sequential communications that I had with Party HQ. And I just wanted the party, the public, and particularly the Fianna Fáil members to know what happened, because they're the people who went out and were ashamed and they were humiliated by all of this. And I also
and what did Party HQ say to you at that time when you expressed an interest in putting your name forward?
Party HQ communicated with my constituency manager on the 20th and the 21st of August. And Rachel, on the 26th of August, I sent an email to Party HQ on the request that it go directly to an Taoiseach. It was a two-page document describing why I thought I could win the election for Fianna Fáil. As far as I'm concerned, it was fairly comprehensive. It trawled back over the votes that I had got from zero to in excess of 90,000 in the European elections. It went back over the type of campaign that I had run, which would be totally different to any presidential campaign. So it comprehensively covered various aspects of a projected campaign.
Mm. And essentially, did the party leadership reply to you then at that time? What sort of response did you get?
Rachel, an Taoiseach contacted me on the 28th of August, which was 2 days after I had emailed that two-page document, and we had a phone call. I was informed by an Taoiseach that Jim Gavin's candidature was at an advanced stage at that point.
From the News at One. And then just a little bit later on Liveline, Ciarán Cuddihy was fielding all kinds of existential issues. Here he is with Fianna Fáil councillor Michael Regan.
Michael, who would you like to see leader of the party for that 100th birthday?
Well, Kieran, I think somebody's got to step aside, first of all. But whenever that happens, I think we have a number of people that's capable of taking the job. And I'm a very democratic person, so I think we will leave that for another day.
Do you think Micheál Martin is a democratic person?
I'll be honest, he's been proven to be a dictator as far as I'm concerned.
A dictator, Michael?
Yeah.
How?
Well, he's bullied his way through the events, as you can see yourself, since last September. But I think it was last July when it all came to a fruition that he wanted Jim Gavin. But yet,
but there was a vote.
At the National Executive, he never told him that he had Jim Gavin in mind, or that he had Jim Gavin there, and yet he told him that he had no candidate. So
I know, but to say he's a dictator, he bullied his way through this. There was a vote, and everybody had a free vote.
Yes, he did, but he picked up the phone and he rang all his ministers and TDs to make sure they voted for him and guarantee them this and guarantee them that. And that's what you do with your leader.
Yeah, well, that's what you do when you're canvassing. I mean, when you go knocking on doors, when you want to be elected, you say, I'll guarantee you this and I'll do this for you. And if you vote for me, this is what I'll do for you. I mean, he was canvassing. I mean, he's open to criticism, like anybody is. But to say he's a dictator.
Well, Kieran, maybe when somebody canvasses you, they might say, Kieran, if you vote for me and we'll give you the Late Late Show job, you might do it. See what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, to call him a bully or a dictator, though, Michael, I mean, that's very strong language. And the fact is, he's the leader of a party that could be ousted tomorrow if somebody formally tabled a motion of no confidence in him. I mean, that doesn't sound very dictatorial to me.
If somebody stands up and has the guts to do that, that's what could happen.
Yeah, but that's my point.
And that's what should happen.
The criticism there is of the other people who might be a party leader, that they're not doing anything about it. I mean, you know, it's a pretty democratic. It's a democratic party, and there's a democratic process to lead it.
Yes, but also, you haven't even mentioned about the hiring of Ivan Yates.
Alas, no, going to have to leave that there. It is Christmas week after all. But there was one little chink of twinkly lights.
Well, the Taoiseach was asked about Santa Claus entering Irish airspace next Tuesday night. He was asked this in the Dáil yesterday afternoon. And Micheál Martin confirmed that the North Pole's best known resident will be able to travel through Irish skies on Christmas Eve. They're monitored now very, very heavily. And he was asked by Meath West TD Aisling Dempsey of Dempsey's dynasty the really important query during leaders' questions on the floor of our national parliament.
Taoiseach, I have a really, really important question to ask you on behalf of all the parents and the carers and on behalf of all the children across Ireland. We have had lots of special visitors and really important visitors to Ireland throughout 2025, but our most important one will arrive here on the 24th of December on Christmas Eve. I would like your personal assurances that our airspace will be clear for Santa, for Rudolph and all of his reindeers to allow them to deliver all the well-deserved presents for the boys and girls in County Meath and across Ireland.
Thank you, Deputy Deputy Taoiseach.
I want to assure the Deputy, I've had consultations with the Minister for Transport, Minister Dara O'Brien, Sean Kenny, and Santa has complete clearance in Irish airspace on that critical timeline that you've outlined, and I think he will arrive on time and with an abundance of toys and so forth for the children of the nation.
He's about to go abundance of caution there, wasn't he? So used to saying it going forward in terms of, it's never so happy to hear a question like that, I'd say now, in all the weeks of recent times. This is a bit of a random text.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. What happens when the Doc on One teams up with the Drama on One? They make a mockumentary. It's called 30 Acres and set on a sprawling ghost estate where we meet the have-nots trying to reclaim some ground from the haves. Oh yes, think overspending in the Tiger era. Did someone say helicopters?
Alistair is here to discuss the future of 30 Acres. And it is fair to say that his presence is imposing. He sports a dark suit that was surely cut on Savile Row. And within minutes, his aftershave has permeated the entire space, wafting through the triple-height kitchen extension like some gorgeous fog.
So, commercial assets aside, I'm looking here at your personal assets. You've sold the three apartments, London, Paris and New York. Mm-hmm. the villa in Tuscany and the ranch in Orlando.
For the first time in my career, I'm privy to the language of Ireland's Celtic Tiger elite.
Right, there's the three vintage cars, the helicopter, the his and hers four-wheel drives.
Yeah, they're all gone, sold. Gone.
Okay, but I see you're still maintaining a stable of five racehorses.
One.
Sorry?
We're just one horse. That's right, all we're left
just
with.
Just the one racehorse. And these veterinary bills, IV, it's a quite a substantial
look,
sum.
Look, the point is we're cutting back, right? It's not like we haven't made sacrifices, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a drop in the ocean, to be honest, Sean. Your losses on the 30-acre estate alone run into millions.
At this point, Pat comes to her husband's aid.
Sorry now, Alistair, but, like, I don't see why we should have to lose everything. I mean, Sean and I have worked incredibly hard for what we have. This marble table didn't just fall out of the sky and onto our laps, you know?
30 acres. Oh, and it's a four-part series, so feel free to treat yourself and listen back to the whole thing. With Oliver, journalist Yvonne Redden. She's armed with a mistletoe and taking no prisoners.
How are you, Oliver? I think we're going to be talking about snogging, are we?
I think we are. I know that we know this is exactly what you want for Christmas. It's a snog. I was telling people earlier on, this is what you're looking for. But tell us about you and your life, Yvonne.
Well, my life is as a single mom, and I have been for 20 years. So obviously the children came first, the parental duties. Very good. Everything else was kind of put aside. But my kids are getting older and it's time for mom to get back out in there, back in the saddle, as they say.
Kids have grown up practically minding themselves.
I have to put out what I want.
And she knows what she wants.
Torpogdom. Give me a kiss.
Oh, I like that. And I need to get a t-shirt with that on, you see. And one of the people I spoke to, a relationship matchmaker, said, go out and wear the t-shirt saying that you want to snog. So I'm in the throes of looking for a t-shirt that says that at the moment, Oliver.
I don't know if you'd need the t-shirt. But you have very standards here now, don't you? You can't just be any old peck or snog. This has to be, you're describing it as a bit of oomph. And happen naturally.
It has to have a bit of oomph. It has to. I mean, you can have them horrible boozy snogs and they mean nothing. Yeah. But this has to be the connection with the eyes, that you have to have that connection straight away. Yeah. Somebody comes over and it's, you know, develops nicely and romantically. There has to be a bit of romance in it. You can't just go and snog some lad that's had a few drinks or whatever. No. It's not the same. You have to have that connection. And I'm being fussy this time round.
Very good. Good for you. You deserve to be. A kiss with a bit of heft in it.
A hefty kiss. And who could blame you? Although perhaps not words you'll find in a Jane Austen novel. But the sentiment, well, she's got a lot to answer for. And this week marked 250 years since her birth. And her work really is the originator of so many of our stories about love. So fasten your bonnets and get ready to take a turn about the room that may well release all kinds of simmering sexual tension. With Rick and Arena, here's Jarlath Killeen, Professor of Victorian English in Trinity.
Pride and Prejudice is essentially the kind of origin text of the entire popular romance genre. And I think that, again, scholars are uncomfortable with that particular reading of it. But in fact, that you can certainly trace even some Mills and Boone romances, popular romances based in the Regency period. They all kind of come back to this sense that Austen did it best. And we're going to draw from her. So I think she's the origin of a particular kind of Englishness and a particular idea of romantic love. And that's really important, I think, for her readers.
I'm interested to know why scholars would be uncomfortable with that read.
I think this is changing. Certainly it's changed in the last, say, 10 to 15 years. But scholars have always been uncomfortable with the romance plot. The plot that involves, the happy ever after ending. And that's all geared towards this coming together of two people overcoming obstacles and getting together in a marriage at the end. And, the popular romance itself is a kind of degraded genre and has been traditionally looked down upon. So you often find scholars, when they write about Austen, saying things like that the love story is not the most important aspect and there's much more going on here. And look what happens at the end. She's not really that interested in the love match because she rushes the ending. She doesn't really show the proposal scene. We're told about the proposal third hand or second hand. We don't get to see the marriages, so that's not really that important. It's all about the quest. It's all about the narrative. There's lots of other things going on. But readers like the romance. and we have to kind of get with that. It's an emotional reaction, emotional relationship that people have with her.
And while there are many contemporary rom-com comparisons, few of us might have seen this coming.
Some people view some of the characters in her novels as archetypes, and they tend to see them everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more striking ones is the popularity of the Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which has essentially the same kind of family structure with the Bennet family in Pride and Prejudice. So we have this mom manager, or mamager, I think they're sometimes referred to, trying to find suitable partners for her five daughters. In a sense, what they're trying to do is modernize Pride and Prejudice to a certain extent. Obviously, Keeping Up with the Kardashians has gone on and on and on and on. But I think that's part of the original attraction of something like Keeping Up with the Kardashians. It taps into that archetype of this mother trying to find the right kind of partners for her girls.
Arena, celebrating the work of Jane Austen. Now, while we're all at risk of being blinded by the fairy lights of Christmas, tomorrow might offer an opportunity to stop, take a breath, and appreciate the earth turning, and us whirling on it.
Where does the time go? On this strange slope and incline we find ourselves on, can we look to the panorama of all things, and can't that include our openness to one another? The need to balm when we hurt, the urge to rest and offer rest. The desire to move towards something different, something deeper, something that pulls us back to who we are, some memory we're tracing the contours of that we know exists but can't quite grasp sometimes.
From the Theatre Collective, this is Pop Baby. And this immersive audio experience has beautiful music and more that you can listen to for around about a half hour as you watch the sunset on the solstice, the shortest day of the year. Una Mullally joined Oliver to talk about Gwynedd.
That's the Irish for a solstice, which literally means sun stop. So I guess it was thought that the sun kind of stops in the sky almost. Yeah, and this time of year, well, on the winter solstice, there's 7.5 hours of light only. So when you compare that to the summer Gwynedd, there's 17 hours of light. So we have this like 9.5 hour difference in light. And that can be, you know, a bit of a struggle. But it also means that at that moment, you know, the brighter days are ahead.
And in an increasingly atomised and online world, this might offer an opportunity for real connection.
I'm thinking of the internet and the fact that we saw this was modernity. This is this great god of the future that we should worship. But people have kind of got to the top of the mountain and discovered there isn't a lot there. Is that why we're now starting to look back into our own history and folklore, our language, the music, all the things that kind of have this?
Yeah, I think it's happening. Irishness. I think it's happening simultaneously. And it's also about, you know, connection to identity, you know, an identity that goes back beyond religiosity or colonialism and stuff like that. You know, that's obviously why the language is having such a huge surge in interest. And also, yeah, people rediscovering mythology and folklore. Obviously, you know, people like Manco McGann were people who really held that a lot for people and offered people an introduction to that as well. Yeah, I just think it is a search for meaning, because there is, you know, an existentialism that drops in when stuff like the pandemic happens or when war happens. You know, people, you know, do search for meaning. And I think that search is ongoing. And it's unearthing really interesting art and really interesting perspectives, you know. So, but yeah, in terms of like the online culture, I just think increasingly people are just moving offline. I just don't think that these kind of fake algorithmic forms of connection are really, you know, working for people, or, you know, people just become entrenched in them and lose perspective.
We've never felt more like the product online.
Yeah, right on, because that's what you are, you know, and you're being steered and, you know, somewhat manipulated into ways of engagement that are actually about fostering conflict. You know, we don't need more conflict. We actually need more contemplation. And so that's kind of what this piece is about as well.
And while this time of year can really be quite difficult, it might also offer an opportunity to regroup.
I think we don't tend to really engage in relaxing things at this time of year. There can be not that much introspection and people are scrambling towards the end of the year. So this is just a moment to kind of, you know, take yourself out of that very frenetic rhythm and try and do something that's a little more in tune with the seasonal change and with the light.
It's funny, I never thought of it like that. We're kind of rushing around organising, buying stuff in order to relax.
Yeah.
Instead of and just doing the relaxing.
It tends not to really happen.
It doesn't happen because then suddenly you're off again.
Yeah.
Did it help you when you were grieving friends and so on?
Yeah, I think definitely. I struggle sometimes to actually take a breath a little bit. You know, like a lot of people, you're just a bit of a hamster wheel type thing. And so working on these kind of things and trying to process them in different ways and knowing really that like grief is the weight of love and trying to navigate one's way out of that and knowing that actually, you know, I think a lot of people, for example, struggle with January, you know, that it feels like this very heavy month. But actually, from Sunday, you know, the days are literally getting brighter.
Yeah, dramatically so.
Dramatically so. And we can, you know, find our ways out of whatever is troubling us or that we're struggling with.
For now, release everything you don't need into the dusk, into this space between, into the next dawn, into the stretch. Because from here on out, the glow is coming. Look. It's already here. It's now. It's returning. The light. The light. The light. The light.
The light. Oh, that is quite beautiful. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Morning Ireland yesterday, a focus on Christmas for the most vulnerable in our society. Gavin spoke to Katrina Toomey of Cork Penny Dinners.
Katrina, tell us about the people you're helping this Christmas.
Well, you know, the way it is now that too many families are finding their, and individuals are finding their incomes falling short of their essential expenses. So rising food prices have pushed food poverty to alarming levels. I suppose for some, the heartbreaking choice again is between, as your speakers have just said, between heating their homes or putting food on the table has become all too real. But the it's just families, it's individuals, it's the working poor. And again, the financial pressures don't stop at the door. The mental health toll, especially among our young people, is profound. There's anxiety, depression and feelings of despair. They're all rising. And we see heartbreaking consequences, increased homelessness, struggles with addiction, and often at the root causes, but tragic symptoms of deeper challenges that people have. So, you know, we can only ask that the government to, how can solutions be truly sustainable? We all know the solutions as well. We just need the government and everybody to buy into what we know and to work from that.
Many of us looking forward to Christmas, many of us not though.
Well, do you know, can you imagine not having any money for Christmas? Because, look, they're barely surviving on what they have. At Christmas, they don't get anything extra. Then the added cost of Christmas can be disastrous for some. And that's just the way it is.
And at the Capuchin Day Centre in Dublin, reporter Joe Caulfield spoke to this man collecting a voucher to help with the Christmas.
It means a lot, you know. It's hard this Christmas for a lot of people. Just to get some toys, get some clothes just for the Christmas. And come down here early just to get in early.
What time are you here queuing at?
I just got here about 7. Okay. So the queue was long enough, so it's going to take me a while to get up.
Absolutely.
But good amounts of people here today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But fair play to them. Like, it's a good thing they're doing. I came last Friday and the queue was still around the thing, but I still queued up and got what I needed, so I'm happy I got my voucher. So.
Yeah, and does that now take a little bit of the pressure off? Do you have a family at home now that you have toys and everything to get for Christmas?
Toys, I've clothes to get for the kids, toys, this will help, you know. Partner's supposed to come down with me, but it's too cold, so we only got the one voucher this year. I had two tickets. I met a fella in the queue that hadn't got a ticket, so I had a spare ticket and gave it to him. So I was like, there's no point. I was going to hand it back to them, you know, and I just, that fella needed it.
Yeah, at least you could help someone else out.
Yeah, it's nice to help someone out, and I feel better for that now.
from Morning Ireland yesterday. With Derek on Mooney Goes Wild, the most Christmassy of birds.
Niall, I know your garden bird survey is underway at the moment, but last year, what was the number one bird? I ask you this for a reason.
It was the greater nocturnal bat's favourite snack, the robin.
The robin, okay. And the reason I ask you, I was walking out of my estate the other day, and when I tell you there was a robin every 20 metres, there was a robin every 20 metres, how do I know? Ask me.
How do you know, Derek?
Have a listen. There you have the winter song of the robin.
Indeed.
And I moved about 20 metres down the footpath and there was another one singing.
Hmm.
And there was another one. Now, I know they're very territorial at this time of year, but Niall, what's going on?
Well, that's exactly it. They're very territorial. And as the temperatures drop and food sources start to become scarcer, that territorial instinct becomes all the stronger because they have to defend a patch that they call their own that's going to provide all their food needs. They don't want any other robin coming in. So when you hear one of them singing like that, that's a challenge to the neighbours. So of course that neighbour just down the road is going to respond, because if it doesn't, it shows itself to be weak. It might even show that it's not prepared to defend its territory. So it sings, and then of course that spurs the next one in the next garden to start singing. So what you were doing there is you're traversing several robin territories on your walk. And the fact that they were quite close together suggests to me that the gardens in the area are probably very good for birds. It suggests that there's quite a lot of food there for robins, so the robins can afford to have smaller territories than they would need if there wasn't so much food around.
And listen up for this really interesting nugget about the kind of song we hear at this time of the year compared to the spring.
And that winter song they're singing there in Niall, is it very different to the breeding season song?
It is different. The main difference is that it's much slower. It's more sort of laid back. And to me, the winter song of the robin, it almost has a kind of melancholy tone to it. There's something sort of almost wistful about it. And then what happens? As we get into the springtime and the days are getting longer, the bird song speeds up. So the robin gets faster and faster until all of a sudden it gets to its summer song. So it's singing the same sort of notes. But because it's faster, it sounds much more jaunty and joyous and literally full of the joys of spring. So when you hear that sort of very slow song like the one you just played there, you know that that's definitely one in the winter. It's not the breeding season one. Most birds in Ireland, of course, don't sing in the winter because they don't need to defend the territory. They just do that during the breeding season in the spring and the summer. But the robins do defend the territory all year round.
Robins, oh so pretty, but always up for the scrap. Now with Brendan at the weekend, Tommy Tiernan, and an ever so slightly jittery opening.
How are you, Tommy?
Brendan, exciting to hear your voice.
And I'm excited to hear yours. Like, you sound excited, I can tell.
Really?
Yeah.
You have a kind of a... there's a lively edge to your voice that I'm... I don't know if I can trust, but I am totally thrilled to hear it.
Tommy, you can always trust me. You know that.
There's people all around the country listening to someone in a Cork accent say, you can always trust me. And they're just not feeling right, Brendan.
No. Tommy, I want you to succeed... I want you to succeed for you and for me, and everyone listening wants this to work so we can do this. So that time of year again, the Tommy Tiernan Show.
Indeed. And in January, we will see another season of the Tommy Tiernan Show. And there's been a lot of them. So a hard question? You would think so.
Just off the top of your head, what stands out for you?
Brenda Fricker.
Yeah.
She's the one. And my imagination goes there straight away when people ask me that question. It's because the interview was so two-sided. Brenda came on and she was asked to do one thing in terms of her clothes, and they said, Brenda, whatever you wear, don't wear black. So she comes on head to toe dressed in black, and she sits there and she had this kind of fierce determined, unapologetic stare. And it was like what I was kind of reading from it, whether it was what was intended or not, was I'm not going to pretend to be happy just for the sake of this television show. And if you're not able to handle my sadness, then that's your responsibility, not mine. So we talked like that for about 20 minutes. And then the interview, she just turned. She just all of a sudden became this
lively, bright-eyed storyteller. And she told an amazing story about Joe Pesci and Al Pacino at the Oscars. And it was because the interview had those two sides of her, that's what made it memorable in for me, is that it was dynamically brilliant in two completely different ways. So that one, so Brenda Fricker.
Yeah, good, good.
Interesting. And while the work continues, all he wants now is a little bit of tomfoolery, maggot acting, general mischief.
You were saying about the it'll finish up, or you'll decide to finish up, or whatever.
Yeah.
Your aim now, work-wise, you're not pursuing a career as such, though, are you? Is it just kind of just do interesting things? What's the next interesting thing?
So I think when you're starting off, when I started off doing stand-up, you have this kind of ego-driven mania. I want to make it as whatever. And that gallops you down the road and you provide for your family and all that, and it's great. And then something happens and you kind of go, that world that I was so obsessed with having status in is actually meaningless to me now. Where's the adventure?
When did that happen?
Yesterday.
I'm so glad that I was here for this moment.
It happened in the Apple Green just beyond the Enfield toll booth. I've just adventure. Where's the sometimes people starting off in stand up ask me, oh, would you have any advice and stuff like that? And it's the only advice that I would ever give to anybody entering a job in comedy is follow the fun. So I'm kind of trying to take my own advice, really. Follow the fun, and whatever happens, the likelihood that you might enjoy it is increased if that's your mantra. Follow the fun. So we'll see where that takes me. But no, I'm a career thing now. I'm mercifully the far side of that, you know. But you wouldn't know what notions would come into your head the next time you pull into the Apple Green, the far side of the toll booth in Enfield. Yeah. So we'll see. But for now, it's about adventure.
Tommy Tiernan with Brendan. And just before we leave that, here's a little bit of TMI for you.
Do you have your own Christmas rituals or anything?
Myself and my wife like to make love at midnight on Christmas Eve.
That's nice.
Thank you. Oh, Brendan, that was the weirdest sounding thing I've ever heard in my life. That sounded like you were kind of hiding in the corner of the room while it was happening and just couldn't help yourself. That's nice.
You just heard the little voice afterwards.
Well, now we all feel a little bit awkward. Jingle the bells, please. Ah, yeah, such a great night. But the next day, not so hot. The headaches, the dodgy tummies, the fear. Oh, God, the fear. Why do we do it? Well, Drive Time asked the big questions.
I think if you've ever had a bad hangover, the mystery is why anyone would ever go near another glass of alcohol again. Because it's horrific. What brings us, keeps us coming back for more?
Have you ever said never again yourself the next morning? Because we all have that feeling.
Oh,
don't
indeed,
we?
Yeah.
It's a strange one. I think it's human behaviour. We're inclined to forget about the bad things and then we do the thing
people
again.
People keep children.
Exactly. The pain of childbirth doesn't put a woman off having another baby. That maybe is part of our psychology, you know. But I think we like to drink. Most societies take some psychoactive substance, remember. It's quite common in us as a species. And in my view, to be pragmatic about it, then you wonder, well, like, if people are going to drink, drink, what are you going to do? Now, interestingly, alcohol consumption is falling dramatically. Maybe people are getting smarter. It's a third down since 2001 in Ireland, which is a big difference, you know. And then the other big one for me was 25% increase this year in zero alcohol products. So things are moving in that direction is the idea, I guess. And maybe people are considering their health a bit more.
And you'll have recognised the voice, Professor Luke O'Neill. For the record, no safe limit for alcohol use, so you have been warned. Elfin safety. But if you will go for it, and so many of you will, we can see you eyeing up the drinks trolley right now. Do yourself a favour. Step away from the port, the red wine. Anything dark, in fact.
There's other chemicals in the darker drinks. They're called congeners, is the technical name for these congeners. And they will make the hangover worse. One congener is methanol, strangely. Now, methanol is another alcohol, but it's much more toxic to our bodies. And darker drinks have slightly more methanol than the clear drinks. So as a result, then the hangover you get the next day is going to be much worse. So if you do want to drink, the advice is try to lay off port or brandy in these ones, because they're inclined to give you a worse hangover than the clearer spirits if you're drinking
Fortified wines. And am I imagining, was red wine likely to cause more damage than a couple of glasses of white wine?
Exactly. The red, again, studies have shown comparing red wine to white wine, the hangover is worse if you have a bottle of red wine than a bottle of white wine. And again, we think it's because of these extra chemicals that are in the red wine are affecting your body in a negative way as well. So the advice there is to go for the white wine if you're going to have a few glasses of wine.
And if the next day you're blindly reaching out for the water, this is why.
Alcohol suppresses a hormone called vasopressin. Vasopressin lowers urine output, and you lower the vasopressin, urine output goes up. Hence, you go to the toilet more, and next thing then you get dehydrated. And a lot of the symptoms are down to dehydration. A big one is the headache. It turns out that there's a fluid around your brain. You lose some liquid from that because your body's dehydrated, and that tightens the meninges around your brain, and then you begin to feel a headache. So dehydration is a big part of the symptoms of a hangover.
And as you check your phone for incriminating messages and just fresh generally about your life choices, and throw in climate change, the state of the world, AI, you name it, at least now you'll know it's all about the chemicals.
So in your brain, you have a natural chemical called glutamate, and that makes you feel a bit anxious. So in a social situation, you make more glutamate, and that's why you have a little bit of anxiety. Alcohol suppresses that. And secondly, another chemical called GABA, that makes you feel relaxed. And guess what? Alcohol boosts that. So it's a perfect combination. You're ramping down the anxiety neurotransmitter and you're boosting the more relaxing. And now you feel the beneficial effects of alcohol, you might say, is the idea. The trouble is, the next day it all rebounds and you get what's called the glutamate rebound. And it's a bit like putting your foot in a spring. It bounces up higher. So when you feel anxious with a hangover, it's because there's too much glutamate in the system and too low levels of GABA. So therefore you feel the opposite that you felt the night before.
Okay, so this is what is commonly known as the fear.
The fear, yeah. The living horrors, as the Irish call it. And of course, the good news is, of course, after a few hours, it settles down again to normal levels and you're back to normal. But certainly in those first few hours after you stop drinking, the glutamate begins to climb and climb and climb. And then you begin to feel, you know, a bit uneasy, and you might begin to regret certain things. Anxiety makes you worry about things that happened the night before. So this is extremely well documented.
And then, of course, the alcohol also makes you forget some of the things that may have happened the night before, which increases the anxiety.
That's right. It's a feed-forward loop here, exactly.
After all that, you'd be tempted for a teetotal Christmas, and who could blame you? But whatever hue of glass you might be raising, you can't go past these toasts. Ask Yelga from Derinniglacken.
You're raising a toast with stout in it. You better be talking about the gut.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
May you never go thirsty, and may you die in Ireland. There's always death, isn't there?
I know, but we love the misery, the romanticism of all the misery, isn't it? Gubflucht, that you always have a wet beak. You never go dry or sober.
By the way, just gubflucht.
Yeah, gubflucht. Yeah, never have thirst. That's
a wet beak. Okay, so Sheena Nullagi is like the phrase of the century, really, for the next few weeks, isn't it?
Absolutely. Sheena Nullagi, it's kind of like your enabling friend telling you now, I don't know about you, I'm an awful woman. I could be convinced to stay for, you know, that extra pint when you have to be in work the next morning.
That's
annoying. Yeah, absolutely. Or when you're buying everybody else a Christmas present, you know, a little Christmas present for you as well. So it's kind of like the phrase used to justify everything, she and Nullagi. And it really goes back to, I suppose, you know, a time in Ireland when we were, there was an awful lot of poverty and buchtiness in the country.
Yeah.
And Christmas was really the only time that you did indulge. So is that, you know, she and Nullagi, if you can't do it now, when can you do it?
Through, this is it. It's grand. You're fine. It's Christmas. She and Nullagi.
That's it. She and Nullagi.
So if you're thinking, I won't go for another mince pie, I've had two.
Oh, she and Nullagi. Get it into you.
That's it.
She and Nullagi and Gubfluck to you all, gentle listener. And that is it for this week's playback. We'll have our playback Best of the Year for you next Saturday. And sure after that, we're into 2026. Have a lovely Christmas. Talk to you in a bit.